Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. On this episode, we have Johnny Olszewski, who is running to be the next county executive in Baltimore County, Maryland.
Even though we have a $3.5 billion budget, we had one budget hearing that no one attended. And so as county executive, I want to take the budget to the people we serve so they can meaningfully understand how we're spending money and solicit their feedback about how to participate. And then also move our county council hearings to the evenings that they currently happen in the middle of the day when people can't participate. And then even things like campaign finance and taking, you know, big special interest out of the mix, creating a public finance option that puts the power back in the hands of our people. And I'm a big believer that the volume of your voice shouldn't be determined by the depths of your pockets.
And then we have the news with me, Brittany, Clint, and Sam, as usual. Brittany is a part of the news, as always, but a little different today. We weren't all together for recording. And the word today is really a just reminder that sometimes you got to walk out. I had an experience recently where I walked into a place and I knew that if I was a white man in a suit, that their reception to me and response would have just been different. And the way that it all went down was like this moment of like, I could still continue and like make this work and try and figure it out. Or I could just say like, this just isn't a place where I need to be. That like, this is not so much that I need to sacrifice values and beliefs to like make this work. So, you know, there are times when we show up in rooms and in places and like, we know things are off and we are afraid to say them or name them or just like remind people that the way we treat each other, like, has to be in equity and justice and always. So sometimes you need to walk out. We need to walk out, walk out. Let's go.
As we all sat and watched the incredibly misogynistic, patriarchal mess that was coming out of Capitol Hill this week in the form of the Kavanaugh hearings and the brave, brave testimony by Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, I'm reminded that we have been afraid of what Kavanaugh could do, not just because of his history in college and in high school and his treatment of women in his personal life, but also because of his treatment of women through the courts. I'm reminded that he has time and time again ruled against a woman's right to choose and a woman's ability to have bodily autonomy, both in the cases of disabled young people and in the case of an immigrant teenager. Those same kinds of behaviors are being seen by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. So essentially, the Office of Refugee Resettlement is forbidding an unaccompanied minor pregnant young woman from getting the abortion that she has decided that she wants for herself. It's important to remind everyone that not only is abortion healthcare, one in four women in their lifetime will have an abortion. So we can't continue to talk about abortion as if it is something that is not happening all over the place and something that needs to happen safely and continue to happen safely. But this young woman has made a choice for herself. She's in the state of Texas and went through the required dealings in order to make sure that she had the kind of bypass that she needed because she is a minor around their parental rights laws. According to Imani Gandhi's work in Rewire News, however, the Office of Refugee Resettlement is blocking her from having access to this abortion. Not only do they do this in a number of cases and block that right for bodily autonomy, they are also blocking her and other young women like her from having full access to information about their choices. So we are seeing that unaccompanied minor young women or young women, period, are immigrating to this country, are trying to make choices for themselves and don't even have access to the information, the full breadth of information that they need in order to make that choice. On top of all of that, though, the Office of Refugee Resettlement is essentially telling the courts that they are justified in blocking this because they consider themselves to be the de facto parent of the young woman who came over. So here's why that is particularly bothersome. I have been in Los Angeles this weekend and I went to the California African American Museum, and it's an incredible place, but there's a really, really powerful exhibit there that was curated by some brilliant folks about slavery in California. Lots of people don't realize that both indigenous people and African-American people were enslaved in the state of California, even though it entered the Union as a free state, even though it was brand new territory and considered to be Western expansion. But the ways in which landowners and wealthy people in California often got around new laws once California statehood was established to keep their enslaved Africans was by promoting themselves as the parent of these enslaved people, as the de facto guardian of enslaved Africans that they brought from other places like Missouri and Texas, etc. So there is a long history of people with ill intent toward young people of color showing themselves to be some kind of caring guardian or parent of those same young people. And in doing that, effectively stripping them of their rights. Just because the manifestation of it in 1850 in California is different than what we're seeing in 2018 in Texas doesn't mean that the principle isn't still the same. I'm really, really saddened by this. And it's important for us to recognize that as we are all sitting and watching this hearing that gripped the entire country, there are so many things happening out of our line of sight that this administration wants to continue to do to strip the rights away from people of color, from immigrants, from women over and over and over again. We have to keep watch, we have to stay alert, and we have to keep talking about this. Thanks to Imani Gandhi for your really important reporting on this. Find the whole article at Rewire News.
What's up, y'all? It's the news. I'm Clint Smith at Clint Smith III.
And I'm Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter.
Mr. Sinyangwe. And this is Deray at Deray on Twitter, D-E-R-A-Y. As you know by now, Brittany is not with us on this recording of the news, but you've already heard her news.
And what you've also probably heard, though I hope you haven't, is another Kanye tweet storm on terrible things with terrible opinions and terrible takes. Again, Kanye's out here with the ahistorical analysis of slavery. He's out here, I don't know whether purposefully or on accident, calling for the abolition of the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery. My man is out here wearing Make America Great Again hats. He's just doing a lot. And the thing about Kanye, we've talked about Kanye before on the pod. It's Kanye, those first three albums, especially for me, were just like huge and seminal and formative pieces of art in my own childhood. It really is sad. I think I'm beyond the point of feeling sad about it, but my man like doesn't make good enough music to be putting crazy stuff out here in the world like that. So at this point I'm almost numb to it because Kanye's gonna do Kanye.
Yeah, I mean it's really sad to see, you know, somebody who we looked up to who appeared to be, you know, not only musically brilliant, but with some of his earlier works also seemed to have some social consciousness as well. And to see sort of how shallow all of that ended up being, right? Either, I don't know where it went, or maybe it just was, you know, sort of surface level at that. And when you dig deeper, you know, there's just isn't something there with regards to sort of historical knowledge, sociopolitical knowledge, all of the things that are really important for somebody with a platform that large to have. And, you know, it's just sad. So, you know, I hope that the people in his life are, you know, reaching out to educate him on issues. And hopefully that does some good over the long term. But in the short term, you know, this is just, you know, episode after episode of, you know, it's embarrassing things that he's saying. And I hope that stops.
You know, he wrote on Instagram that, like, the 13th Amendment is really slavery in disguise. And you're like, I don't even know what that means.
What are you even trying to say?
Like the loophole in the 13th Amendment?
You're like, oh, this seems like a problem. So I don't know. And then for him to say that people are bullying him is, I think, the most sort of frustrating thing, because that is creating space for so many white supremacists who use the same language. Like the people who wish harm on communities, don't believe in equity, don't believe in justice. In the moment, you're like, well, that's racist. They're like, oh, you're being a bully. You're like, no, you're just being racist. And Kanye is like very publicly providing a cover for those people and creating space for them. And that is what's so dangerous about it. But there's been a lot going on this week in the news, and we can't ignore the Kavanaugh hearings or the FBI investigation, if we can even call it an investigation.
Yeah, I think like so many people, I sat in front of my TV last week and watched Dr. Ford so courageously, so bravely, so profoundly express the very real harm that she had experienced all these decades ago, and And I can't remember the last time I sat in front of a TV for that long since I was like 9 years old watching Power Rangers or something. But among many things, what I most took away was, again, Dr. Ford's bravery, and to watch both online and in person as so many women and girls expressed a profound, not only solidarity, but I think her testimony has opened up an even larger space than perhaps existed, you know, even in the midst of the Me Too movement, around what it means to have public discourse and to publicly discuss and to publicly reckon with, and not even necessarily publicly, for people to reckon with their own experience with sexual assault and sexual misconduct. And it was staggering to just kind of step back and see so many women share her story and her experience, and not obviously not only women, and just a lot of people, but I think I'm still processing so much of that.
Yeah, I mean, it is sad to see how much courageousness, how much bravery, how much heroism, right? Extraordinary heroism it takes to even get this FBI investigation, this 1 week limited FBI investigation, to even push them to investigate the sexual assault allegations has taken so much from so many people, putting literally their lives on the line. And yet, and still, we're in a system. It's also a reminder of how systemic these inequities are, where you have a situation where even when it's an investigation, the agency doing the investigation, the FBI, is disproportionately white and male. The people who are defining the scope of the investigation are the Trump administration, which, as we've seen, is now exercising its power to limit the scope of that investigation. So, at every step, it takes a massive effort, and then the system will respond in ways that don't even honor the commitment of those who it's supposed to be responding to. And so, it's sad. And at the same time, it's a reminder that when we look at this type of nominee, there are so many things that we've heard in addition to the sexual assault allegations, which alone should be disqualifying. But it seems that over the course of these hearings now, we've seen Kavanaugh lie again and again and again and again. Most recently, one of the lies was during this past hearing where he said that he got into Yale all on his own because of his hard work. And so, the quote that he gave in that hearing last week was, "I have no connections to Yale. I got there by busting my tail." So we've come to find out through reporting from Newsweek that, in fact, Kavanaugh's grandfather went to Yale, which means that Kavanaugh himself was a legacy student. And by definition, a legacy student is a student that, through no work of their own, no effort of their own, just because they were a child or a grandchild of somebody who also went to Yale, they got an unearned advantage in getting in. So when you look at the data, Yale, last year, so for the class of 2021, 12% of students accepted into Yale were legacy students, compared to 11.7% of students who were Black students. So the total Black population, and about 13% of students who were Latino. And so you have a situation where, the size of the legacy student body is comparable to, and in many schools like Harvard, far larger than the total student body of Black students or the total student body of Latino students. And so, this is a entitlement, right? Legacy admissions. It's an entitlement that reflects nothing about you coming from hardship or having to overcome barriers to opportunity as a consequence of your race. Instead, this is literally an entitlement based on the fact that you came from a legacy of privilege, right? That your parent went to Yale, right? Or grandparent went to Yale. And yet we don't see that at all being part of the conversation around what types of admissions policies need to change. We don't see the Supreme Court, taking up cases to challenge the efficacy of legacy admissions policies. Instead, they have attacked, and if Kavanaugh gets confirmed, they may well dismantle affirmative action to the extent that it benefits people of color.
Yeah, Sam, I think you bring up a really important point. I mean, one, even if we were operating in a context in which we were to say that he he did not commit sexual assault. I believe Dr. Ford. I believe what she's saying. But for this hypothetical, let's say that he didn't actually was not actually the person who did this. Beyond the alleged sexual assault, this man, he got up there and demonstrably and clearly lied time after time after time after time. CurrentAffairs.com did an extensive breakdown of like every instance of lying that he engaged in while he was under oath. And many newspapers and magazines and outlets have reported extensively on this. And so, you know, beyond the sort of unprecedented external espousal of partisanship, right? Like calling what happened to him a witch hunt, a Clinton of the Clintonites, and literally looking at all the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee and haranguing them and just like inveighing against them again and again and again in remarkably personal terms. So I think the idea that this person could ever be on the Supreme Court and like operate under the pretense of neutrality and objectivity, you know, even though it is largely a pretense, I don't know how we move forward from that. But to your latter point, I think, you know, what you bring up about legacy is really important. I didn't even know until you brought that up that his grandfather was a student at Yale. I mean, even if his grandfather wasn't a student at Yale, I think there's certainly something to be said about the fact that you went to Georgetown Prep and that you grew up in one of the wealthiest suburbs in America, and that you are a white man, and that you know have all of these systems of advantages, and that you would say that I got there through nothing but my own hard work. So that's already, you know, a bunch of baloney. But the fact that his grandfather actually makes him a legacy student, like empirically, is pretty, again, pretty stunning that he just got up there and lied. And what's interesting, you know, I am, as you all know, a student at Harvard in the PhD program, and I appreciate the school in many ways. But what's fascinating is that Harvard's incoming class of 2021 is made up of 29% legacy students, according to the Harvard Crimson. And last year, applicants who had Harvard in their blood were 3 times more likely to get into the school than those without. And what's interesting is there was
3 times.
3 times. And across the top 30 schools in the United States, in a piece that was discussed in the Washington Post, it found that children of alumni, quote, had a 45% greater chance of admission than other applicants. The New York Times found that 5 Ivy League schools, Dartmouth, Princeton, Yale, Penn, and Brown, at those schools, there were more students from families in the top 1% than there were from the entire bottom 60%. And so all this is to say that, like, there is profound inequity on these campuses. And you know, many of these schools, and Harvard is included in that, has done a lot of work to increase inclusion, increase diversity, increase opportunities for low-income students by not having them have to take out loans in order to go there. And I think that those are good things, to be sure. But it is, I mean, still almost a third of the student body at Harvard and so many of these other schools is made up of students who are direct legacies. And that is, in my mind, that's kind of unconscionable. But it again shows that there are so many people who believe that they inherently deserve the things that they have, and aren't willing to acknowledge that, that they may have worked hard and they likely did work hard, but that hard work was supplemented by a very real set of sort of like intergenerational opportunities that other people simply don't have access to.
You know, Clint, that makes me think about one of the ways that whiteness works is the myth of self-making and self-mastery. And Kavanaugh might be the best public example of that in recent times, that this notion that he himself did everything, didn't benefit from anything, that is self-making in its finest. And then when pressed on his qualifications and he's like, I was an athlete. I like to, you're like, really? Is that really like what qualifies you to be on the Supreme Court? You were an athlete 30 years ago? And that is like that's like how the self-mastery begins. It's like this long road of like, I did these things. I mastered it. I didn't benefit. You know, what's interesting, especially from the Republicans and just the way whiteness works in general is that they never, that self-mastery and self-making is never ever extended to anybody else, and it's always explicitly denied. So they are the first people to tell, make sure that welfare, people on welfare know that they got government assistance and that they shouldn't be getting any assistance, because if they were strong, capable people, they would be doing everything on their own. It's like, well, you didn't do everything on your own. Like, that's not, like, you're making this bar that nobody else did. I'll also say, there was somebody I went to college with, Emily. She had this Facebook post that I reposted because it was so brilliant. And I'll just read it. She said, folks who were talking about Serena's meltdown, this is a meltdown. In the middle of a hearing regarding sexual assault with a nomination for the Supreme Court of the United States hanging in the balance, Kavanaugh has yelled, cried, interrupted senators, and demanded they, quote, let him finish. Obviously, being a sexual predator should be disqualifying for a Supreme Court judge. But if we're honest, everything Kavanaugh has presented is disqualifying. His temperament is petulant and erratic, bordering on belligerent. His candor is lacking. His credibility is shot. If you've ever asked what white male privilege is, here's your tutorial. And, like, I think that's it. When I saw him cut off Senator Leahy, I was like, oh, this is really something else. And, like, he's a judge. He would find a lawyer in contempt of court if they talked to him the way he talked to those senators. That was just wild to watch. And, Sam, you had brought up this legacy stuff before, how there are more legacy students and students of color in most of these places. And that still is, like, it's still one of those things that every time you say it, I'm like, wow, that is really special. Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
So, some better news that's happened this week that didn't probably understandably get as much attention as so much of what has been happening regarding Kavanaugh and elsewhere is that the Center for American Progress just had a report that they released on the impact of universal pre-K. So in 2009, D.C. began an ambitious project that offered 2 years of universal full day preschool across the city's public schools, public charter schools, and even some private preschool programs that were administrated by community-based organizations. And as of 2017, approximately 9 out of 10 of D.C.'s 4-year-olds and 7 out of 10 of D.C.'s 3-year-olds were enrolled in publicly funded preschool through this expansion. So that was it by itself like a remarkable achievement. And so while this policy was introduced largely with the goal of improving school readiness, since all the studies and social science have shown us that preschool attendance has shown to improve children's academic and socio-emotional skills, young parents soon found that those 2 years of free, high-quality care actually had a huge economic benefit for them in ways that were not necessarily projected or weren't necessarily the goal of the original the expansion. And so this new report by the Center for American Progress shows that public preschool also allows some parents to re-enter the labor force and increase the number of hours that they work, providing a boom for the economic well-being, obviously, of those families. And that has been the experience of people in Washington, D.C., and specifically mothers who have returned or entered the workforce in significant numbers since the city expanded universal pre-K. And so in the years since D.C. implemented this program, the maternal labor force participation rate has increased by about 12%, and 10 of those percentage points can be attributed to preschool expansion. So as we think about what it means to close the wage gap between men and women, a gap that sociologists have talked about as being largely tied to what they call a motherhood gap for people who have children and then are unable to work the same hours, or often women find themselves in positions where they are stepping back from work more so than their male counterparts. But this study is really amazing because it shows that there is like a really significant improvement, an increase in women's participation in the workforce and their sort of economic returns in ways that are really kind of an additional benefit to a program that was hoping to increase school readiness for kids. But now we're also finding that it's decreasing the pay gap between men and women by decreasing the motherhood gap. So this is good news, and I was excited to see it.
So I was actually unaware that DC was implementing universal preschool. And in reading more about this, particularly from some of the research that the Center for American Progress has made available, DC is not alone. So DC plus 7 other states have implemented programs that cover at least half of 4-year-olds. So, you know, obviously universal preschool is far more than half, but only 7 states even cover half of 4-year-olds in publicly funded preschools. And according to research estimates, for every state to implement a universal preschool model, it would actually save $83 billion a year.
Wow.
In costs, right, over the long term. And so, you know, these are programs that, you know, for all the reasons you mentioned, Clint, benefit not only the kids, but benefit families, benefit mothers, benefit communities as a whole. And, you know, there's really not a good reason not to implement these programs, right? These are things, and I remember under the Obama administration, every State of the Union speech, he would talk about, we need universal pre-K, and he would talk about all of these benefits, and Republicans never would appropriate the funds. But what's important here is that that conversation has continued. That conversation has been such a, you know, universal preschool has been such a part of the broader conversation, particularly under the Obama administration, that it appears to also have influenced states as well to take action and to begin to implement these things on their own. And it's good to see that that's, you know, happening in places like DC and at least seven other states. And I'm hopeful that, you know, we can continue to push at the state level while this administration federally obviously doesn't appear to be interested in these types of things, but push at the state level to implement more and better preschool opportunities for kids, because we know that this makes a difference over the long term in everybody's life.
Clint, this was something that definitely missed my radar. I hadn't seen this at all. You already talked about the impact on the maternal workforce, allowing mothers to participate. It's interesting when we talk about closing the wealth gap, there are some things that we know don't work, but there are some things that we know do work. And it is this access to childcare is a big part of one of the barriers for women to participate in the labor force in a way that is equitable and makes sense. So this provides one of those tangible things that like states, cities can do to actually address the wealth gap in a way that is also addressing other things like, you know, kids being able to read and write. I remember when I was in Baltimore City Public Schools, our data showed at the time that young people that participated in like structured programs before kindergarten did better in kindergarten. So it was we always wanted kids to be in like a head start or in some sort of pre-K just because they'd be much more ready. So the thought that there's full day pre-K in a lot of places, and Sam already talked about how full day pre-K is not everywhere, but a lot of places have half day pre-K, which is better than nothing, but still a burden on a lot of families. Cause like somebody got to get the kid at the half day. And like that actually still creates a burden. What I will say, the most interesting part of this for me is that DC funds the full day pre-K with the same formula that it funds K-12, which sounds really wonky, but is a huge deal because the preschool teachers are being paid just as much as any other teacher. Like they are treated as a part of the workforce in the school system the same. And what that means is that in 2017, for instance, the district spent about $17,000 per child enrolled in public preschool, which is huge. Comparable, Georgia spends about $4,000 per child enrolled in its universal preschool program, right? So it's not only that there's a program that has access in DC, but the program is actually designed to be as robust as the rest of the academic program. And that actually matters.
That's a really important point.
So my news is about immigration and about young people again. You might have seen an article that talked about an update on what happened to the kids who have been taken by ICE or the Office of Refugee Resettlement, is that what we now have found out is that those kids are actually in like another version of a tent city. So we had somebody on the pod not too long ago who talked about the Office of Refugee Resettlement and noted that most of the kids, the majority of the kids, a vast majority of kids like under 18 who get taken in the custody of the immigration officials go to some sort of like foster care, group home, shelter, something like that. So they're still essentially captive, but they're in like a group home setting and they receive schooling and they receive regular visits with legal representatives who are assigned to their cases or who they have. But now they have been put in tents in groups of 20 separated by gender and sleep lined up in bunks. No school. They're given workbooks, but they have no obligation to complete them. And they have limited, if any, access to legal services. And we know this because some of the shelter workers who previously worked in some of the shelters and now are working at this new tent thing have spoken out anonymously because they know that it doesn't make any sense. And what shocked me even more was that when they have to appear before the immigration court, they're actually doing it over video. And like, you know, on the podcast before, we talked about how so few of the young people have representation because it's not required. And you don't have a right to representation in immigration court. It's a civil court. And yeah, they're doing it over video. So like imagine being like a 10-year-old having like the most important hearing of your life over video with no lawyer. So it's as egregious as it was before. The context has just changed.
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, I'm always, as I've talked about before, always thinking about this as a parent. And I just, I can't even begin to wrap my head around how frightening this is for the parents and much less the children. I mean, I just want people to take a second and sort of imagine being a 12-year-old child, being woken up in the middle of the night, told to pack whatever small amount of things you have with you. You're put on a bus under the cover of night with absolutely no idea where you're going, where you're being taken. You have no communication with your family. And I just imagine the fear and the anxiety and the desperation. I almost don't have words. I think, you know, there's so much that enrages me about this administration, obviously, but what they have put these kids through in the way that we know and how we know how trauma works and how we know what these kids are going to have to live with and try to overcome, you know, for the rest of their lives is something that lights a fire under me in a way that few things have before.
Yeah, I mean, it's obscene what this administration has been doing to these kids. And, you know, so much of the conversation has focused on, you know, and rightly so, it's focused on the kids that have been separated from their parents at the border and, you know, put in these detention facilities. And, you know, according to the data, the majority of those kids have been reunited with their parents, although there are still some who have not been. But, you know, unaccompanied minors, those who do not come with their parents, you know, that's actually a much larger population of kids who are, you know, increasingly becoming part of this large, sprawling, you know, tent center or detention center. And, you know, what's wild about that is that you see, because these are unaccompanied children, there are, you know, there are people out there, many people even in the United States, whether it's, you know, family members or, you know, others who want to take these kids in. And the administration has actually been making it harder for those people to actually, you know, apply for and then ultimately get those kids released and put into their care because the administration has been taking steps, you know, for example, raiding homes of people who are connected to, who are family members of or connected to, you know, these unaccompanied children in the United States. Has been, you know, making it very clear that they are going to be trying to identify every single person who is in the home or is connected to somebody who applies to take care of one of those kids. And so what that does is it actually has been reducing the number of families who've been applying to care for these kids and as a consequence, leaving these kids in detention centers indefinitely.
Oh, wow.
And so that is sort of directly contributing to these detention centers having so many kids and growing and none of those kids actually being released in any timely fashion. So, you know, the administration continues to make life harder for these kids. And, it, you know, again, these are children without their parents. And to think of the government, you know, intentionally taking steps to make their lives harder, to put them in these detention centers indefinitely, it's just evil, you know, when you think about it and something that needs to be urgently addressed.
That's the news.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come.
And here's my conversation with John Olszewski, candidate to be the next county executive in Baltimore County, Maryland. John, thanks so much for joining us today on Pod Save the People.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're running for a county executive in Baltimore County. People often confuse Baltimore City and Baltimore County. I went to high school and middle school in the county. And you're from the county, right?
I am born and bred over in eastern Baltimore County in the shadow of a steel mill.
And you were elected to the Maryland General Assembly at a really young age, 23, I think. What made you want to run for county executive? How did you get here? Like, why this office?
So a lot of it has just been a function of my life experiences. Growing up in Baltimore County, I was the product of the county school system. I remember hearing the blast furnace growing up. And for me, that sound was always gritty. But in many ways, it was always very comforting, and that I knew that it meant that people were able to pursue their version of the American dream. They had good wages, they had health benefits, they had a pension. But I also saw what happened as those jobs slipped away and as the mill closed and as people lost jobs, they lost their health care, they lost their home, they lost hope. In the midst of all those struggles, you know, I was lucky enough that I had a community and a family that invested in me. So I was able to be the first in my family to go to college here in Baltimore County. It's where I met my wife. I've continued my education and recently graduated with a PhD at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And so in light of what I witnessed growing up, that's why I resolved to return home so I could fight to improve the community that gave me so much and that I grew up in. I wanted to give back, so I returned to become a special education and social studies teacher in the same school system I went through. And that's why I ran for the legislature and was lucky enough to be someone early on who represented my hometown. And we didn't shy away from the big fights. So, you know, now my wife and I are raising a family here in Baltimore County, and it's a future that we're focused on. And as you know, it's one that's more uncertain now than ever before, but I'm running to secure that future for my daughter and for all the kids of our county. And we can do that by doing big things and bold and innovative things and doing them right now. So that's why we're doing this.
And how did your experience teaching inform the way you think about change, the way you think about politics and the work ahead, the work that has to be done?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, unfortunately, in both Baltimore City and Baltimore County, we have a lot of ways to go. And for all of the things that Baltimore County has done right, we have incredible inequity in our school systems, and that's largely based on the zip code in which our children live. We still have rampant housing discrimination, and there's a real sense of frustration that our government isn't the open, accessible, and connected government it should be. So as I think through my experiences as a teacher, having spent the 5 years as a socialized and special ed teacher in Baltimore County, and then as a resource for two more, trying to connect parents more meaningful with their kids' education. The thing that I remember most, really, are the kids who came to school hungry and who couldn't focus on their work, or the kids who struggled to learn because of sweltering heat and not having air conditioning, and think about the buzzing of the box fans in the background. But I also remember the incredible dedication that so many of my colleagues exhibited, staying after school, coming in on weekends, usually without compensation, to make sure that our kids had the best possible chance to pass the state mandated test for graduation. And it struck me that there was an incredible disconnect between the classroom conditions and just the sheer dedication that teachers exhibited towards their students, and how absolutely aware we need to be that a child's circumstance matters, and that we need to do something about filling those opportunity gaps that exist out there.
And you recently come out advocating for universal pre-K. What led you to that decision? There aren't as many places around the country that we would like to have universal pre-K. It's actually more rare than people think. So why are you pushing for it here in Baltimore County?
Yeah, I mean, schools are the top priority in my campaign, and universal pre-K is just one piece of giving our kids the best start possible. And both in my experiences as a new parent, but also through my time in the classroom, the one thing that we share, no matter where we come from, is a classroom. And as Baltimore County Executive, I want to make sure that these classrooms present the same opportunity for every single student that goes through them, and that our campaign has a holistic approach, but it starts with pre-K. And I think it's the most important single step we can make towards leveling the playing field. Research on the benefits of pre-K is overwhelming. It's conclusive. Students who have pre-K have higher lifetime earnings, they commit fewer crimes, they're more likely to graduate from high school, and the benefits are pretty overwhelming. One study had it as $8.90 for every dollar that we spend, and I think it's much better to invest our resources in our students than it is to incarcerate our residents later on. It's an investment we have to make, and I think we can't afford not to.
And how would you help people, like, just describe what a county executive does? Is it synonymous with the mayor? Like, how do you talk to people about what the role is who just aren't familiar?
So Baltimore County has over 830,000 residents, an annual budget of $3.5 billion, and thousands of employees. It's larger than states like Wyoming and Vermont. It's larger, as you mentioned earlier, than Baltimore City and even Washington, D.C. And the role of county executive is essentially the mayor or the chief executive. And it's a place where what's exciting about the local level, there's actually a tremendous opportunity to make progress in the areas that people care about the most and that impacts their lives the most, whether that's our school systems or our job creation, trash, roadways and sidewalks, or permits. In some ways, it's really the single greatest way to positively or negatively impact the lives of nearly a million people. And so when you think about it that way, it's actually a pretty awesome responsibility.
And I know we've covered some of the issues already, but what would you say are the top three issues to Baltimore County voters that you want to tackle? Like, what would they be?
Yeah, so my campaign is focused on three areas: schools, jobs, and making local government accessible, transparent, and connected. So in schools, I know we touched on universal pre-K, but I also want to enact a universal breakfast and lunch program here in Baltimore County. We have to invest more meaningfully in our school infrastructure. We have schools that still literally have brown drinking water and schools that are sliding into the ground. And I want us to see Baltimore County enact community schools where we have more holistic needs of children and their families met, where we do things like provide healthcare and job training and language classes to not only meet the needs of our students, but also their families. On jobs, I want us to have more opportunity and economic justice and believe that anyone who wants a job should be able to have one. And we should make that opportunity available for all our residents. And we can do that by doing things like investing in trades, both traditional and those of the future, through things like free community colleges, certification programs, partnering with our private sector, and using innovation to unlock our potential. You know, we're the only major jurisdiction in Maryland without any arts and entertainment districts, for example. And then finally, reforming local government. Technology, I think, is an important way to harness what's possible and serve people better. My life is in my phone. We have our banking statements, photo albums, music, but in Baltimore County, people can't interact with their government that way. So I also want to do that and things like adding transparency. For example, even though we have a $3.5 billion budget, we had one budget hearing that no one attended. And so as county executive, I want to take the budget to the people we serve so they can meaningfully understand how we're spending money and solicit their feedback about how to participate. And then also move our county council hearings to the evenings, that they currently happen in the middle of the day when people can't participate. And then even things like campaign finance and taking, you know, big special interest out of the mix, creating a public finance option that puts the power back in the hands of our people. And I'm a big believer that the volume of your voice shouldn't be determined by the depths of your pockets.
Now, there's so many people in this moment who are losing hope, who feel like they've been to a protest, they've called, they emailed, they've testified at the hearing, and like it actually hasn't turned into what they wanted it to. What do you say to those people?
I mean, I guess I think about an experience I had with a student, a former student that approached me in a local restaurant a few months ago. It was pretty unexpected because it was a student that sort of skirted by with average grades and he wasn't especially involved in activities. You know, I worked pretty closely with this young man during his 4 years of the high school and I pushed him academically and socially, you know, want him as all of my students to dream big about what they could accomplish and sort of let him go. He graduated without much interaction. But he came to thank me over 10 years later for helping to instill in him a confidence that wasn't picked up until later. He's joined a local union, earned a trade, is getting married. And so for that kid, it wasn't about what happened in the moment. It was about planting the seed. And so oftentimes we just don't see the fruits of those seeds until we plant it much later. So I would offer the same advice to people who are engaging in campaigns or attending protests or rallies that, you know, sometimes those seeds take time to come to fruition. And that's what running for office is about. That's what helping campaigns are about. That's what attending these rallies and protests is about, is planting those seeds that we can see the positive outcome of those efforts.
And one of the questions we ask everybody is there any piece of advice that you've gotten over the years that stuck with you?
Absolutely. You know, my high school math teacher, Mrs. Thomas, used to always remind me that life is like a coin. You get to spend it any way that you like, but you only get to spend it once. And so that's really stuck with me as something where I know that I want people to remember me for spending that coin on giving others the same opportunities that I've had and for caring about people by doing things to enable them to be successful by, you know, promoting relationships, creating opportunity, celebrating diversity, tearing down barriers to success. And, you know, it reminds me that our days are numbered here, no matter how much money we make or what offices we hold. So what really matters is what we're doing for those that come after us, for my daughter, for our other kids, for future generations. What are we doing to leave this world just a little bit better than the way we found it?
And where can people go to find more information about the campaign, to follow you, to learn more, to donate, to volunteer?
Sure. We'd love to have people check out our website. It's just gojohnnyo.com. It's gojohnnyo.com. Or check me out on Twitter. I'm at Johnny O Jr.
Well, thanks so much, Johnny O. And I wish you the best of luck on the campaign. I've donated, and knock it out. And we consider you a friend of the pod.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for listening to Pod Save the People. Make sure you rate us wherever you get your podcasts, and we will see you next week.